Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm your host, S.E. Fleenor, and today I am riding solo. The lovely Sarah was going to be here with us, but, you know, this is life. Sometimes things fall apart. And, you know, I hope next year finds us together more. It's been cool to have us doing solo things. I've been hearing a lot of neat interviews and cool conversations Sarah has been having, and Sarah and Monica have been having too. But, you know, I'm a little nostalgic for the times we'll be all together again. So I guess that's just to say I love you, Sarah. I love you, Monica. I'll see you next time. But you know what? I'm actually super pumped. Today we have a super cool guest here with us. I just want to welcome to the podcast Jeremy Holt. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me.
Yay! Jeremy is the creator behind the awesome graphic novel Gatsby that we're going to talk about today. But also, you know, Jeremy, you've done all kinds of stuff. So why don't we give our listeners a little introduction to, I don't know, life according to Jeremy.
Sure. My name is Jeremy Holt. I've been writing comic books and graphic novels for 15, 16 years now. Gatsby is actually my 9th publication, but the majority of my work has been out through smaller publishers. So not surprised that I've been interviewed and asked, like, oh, wow, you just broke in. And it's like, not really.
Not, I mean, really.
Breaking in is a construct in and of itself anyway.
Well said. Yeah, you know, I was actually talking to a friend about that who, you know, she sort of quote unquote broke in with her first novel. And now she's like, well, now I'm going to break in somewhere else and do something slightly different, you know? And it's like, oh, right, because you're never... I mean, maybe once you reach a certain echelon of success and your name is a more household name, maybe. But I mean, it feels like it's kind of like you're constantly trying to break into the next level, the next piece. I don't know. Maybe I'm projecting, but I wonder if that's part of what you feel, Jeremy.
Yeah, I think really why it feels like it's breaking in constantly rather than suddenly is that the reality is that editorial changes. So it's about making connections with editors and publishers. And, you know, it's pretty common for someone in my position to develop a relationship with an editor, and that editor moves to a different house. And so you sort of have to start over. And so the breaking in is really a moving target. And once you hit that target, you know, you sort of get through that threshold, but that target keeps moving for everybody else. So, you know, the way I got in isn't the same way my friends got in, isn't going to be the same way that people after me get in.
Absolutely. You know, that was another piece we were talking about is sometimes it's so annoying to get advice from people who broke 30 years ago, right? Because it's like, no, it's a whole different game, you know, like through whatever level that is. You know, it's like, oh, well, that doesn't work the same way anymore, or those things aren't there anymore. So yeah, it is interesting. I think, you know, we came back to, and I'm curious how this will sit for you, to the idea that, you know, really you can chase success and you can chase breaking through, and why not go for it? Like, you got the energy, why not shoot for the stars, so to speak? But, you know, really all there is at the end of the day is the work.
Yeah, you have to enjoy what you're doing. For me, obviously it's important to have goals. My goal was to be published. My goal was to be a full-time writer. And along the way, the fun in creating these stories started to lose its luster. And it took me years to understand why that was. And it was because these goals I had set for myself sort of had been written in stone. And once I realized that it's important to have goals, but it's equally important to move those goalposts. So the first one I moved was writing full-time. I used to tell myself this story that if I wasn't a full-time writer, then I wasn't a real writer. I wasn't a legitimate writer. And once I started hearing stories of famous authors who held day jobs up until the end, I think T.S. Eliot is a good example of that. It recontextualized what was important. It wasn't that goal. It was enjoying the work. And so I enjoyed my day job because I realized my relationship to my creativity, there was some latitude there, and I didn't have to depend on my stories to feed me and keep a roof over my head.
Mm. you know, we dove right into the deep end. We're like, tell me about your soul, Jeremy. I mean, really? No, because I'm really touched by that. The idea that sort of recontextualizing what your goals mean as you grow as a creative and seeing, you know, I was even Charlie June Anders was just writing about, you know, in her newsletter, one of the things that almost all, she says, writers have to have is a good day job. A low stress day job, I think, is one of the pieces that she put as the qualifiers. And I think that's really real for a lot of creatives. I think there are some of us who get to be full time with our creative work. And honestly, there are downsides there, too, because you're right. There's something about having the roof over your head tied to, can you write? That can, I don't know, sometimes make it really hard for me to write.
It can. I think the act of writing is harder than having written something. I think most writers enjoy having written something, but the process of it is labor-intensive, is stressful. I think all of us are, in a way, natural procrastinators because once you get into the headspace, it's, you know, the words fly out of your fingertips, but it's getting down, sitting in that proverbial chair, which can be the hardest struggle. And, you know, life gets in the way and it's so much easier to go, well, I got to deal with this instead of do that thing. And for me, I've had the fortune of having a day job and being creative and then going full-time freelance, which presented new stressors that some I was prepared for, some I was not prepared for. Mm. And it has taught me that I do have the capability of doing this. However, it took years and years to develop a process that no matter what my headspace was in, if I relied on the process I had constructed, I knew I was going to be productive that day. And that is the most important tool for me.
Ooh, so, okay, can we talk about that process? You don't have to give away all the secret sauce, but, you know, is it writing at the same time? Is it doing certain things before you write? I'm just fascinated.
It's mostly, honestly, having somebody want something from me is a big motivator. So I have a literary agent, which I feel very fortunate to have, and she is always encouraging me to write outside my wheelhouse. I tend to write darker, more adult-themed stories, and she's been pushing me into the middle grade market, which I've finally acquiesced, and I've had a lot of fun doing it. So it's nice where someone wants something, so I get motivated to do that. And I have a lot of fun breaking story on the outline phase. So when I'm writing a synopsis, for example, you know, 1 to 3 pages, you know, broad strokes of the story, that's where, like, I'm playing in a sandbox, essentially, and I'm living with these characters, and I'm designing them, and I'm creating the entire cast and the conflicts and the beginning, middle, end. And once I have that, that's really where the heavy creative lifting is done for me. So once that's in place, and I revise it multiple times with my agent, you know, I move on to scripts. And the thing that I've heard that works really well for me is always sort of end in the middle of a scene where you're excited to get back to it the next day rather than ending, you know, on a downbeat or the end of a scene, because it can be harder to start back up the next day.
Yes, I recently heard that as well. And I've been trying to do that more. And it has been, I think it's been helpful if a bit, it's hard for me to stop if I'm like feeling it. I find it very hard to be like transitions are my nightmare. I'm like off or on, you know what I mean? Like I am writing a ridiculous amount every day or I'm not writing at all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's neither here nor there. I think that goes back to the old neurodivergence thing. But, you know, it's definitely been interesting. It's interesting to hear about your process. I also thrive on a deadline. I'm like, oh, yeah, something's due. Oh, suddenly I'm like brilliant.
It's a great push out of the nest kind of thing. But I think what you said is really accurate, where I also will write a ton for days on end and then am what I perceive to be unproductive for like a week. And I realized that I had to also let go of this narrative that, you know, writing every day means you're a writer, which I believed and I held that as sort of my gospel for years. And I realized there's a lot going on in my head on the down moments of just sitting with something and letting it simmer and think about it and expand it in my mind. And that is still a type of work. You don't have to be pounding out words every day to be considered productive. So it's just kind of being more gentle with yourself in a lot of ways.
Isn't that like the weirdest part is like, or to me, I guess that's the weirdest part because I had internalized exactly as you have, you know, you got to write every day. Discipline. What I most need is more discipline and I need to be hard with myself. And if I miss a day, I must be mad. And I realized it was the opposite. It was actually gentleness and respect for my process and respect for the fact that maybe I don't know all of my process or that maybe it changes with different projects. Like if I'm writing something really heavy, maybe I need more space between the writing days. Or maybe if I'm, you know, it's a story I've been sitting with for years, I need to say, hey, I'm going to clear my schedule for a couple weeks and just go hard at it. But that's, I want it to be predictable. I want it to make sense. And I've had to come to the place of like, I neither buy that you have to be super disciplined, nor do I buy that like you have to wait for the muse. You know what I mean? I think it's somewhere in between.
And I think that in between for me is the sort of the process I was describing where, you know, it doesn't matter if I start that process at 7 a.m. or 1 in the afternoon. I know that once I get locked in, I'm going to produce a certain amount of work and I can hit those deadlines. And I've never missed a deadline. So, you know, I don't plan on starting.
Well, that is, you know, I cannot speak so boldly as to say I've never missed a deadline, but I have a lot of respect for that. And I mean, I think that's the other piece too, is learning that I really did think, you know, I really bought into it. It was like, if you write at 7 a.m. every day, like you'll be able to write at 7 a.m. every day. And I think that's true to some degree, but not for me. After a certain number of weeks at writing at 7 a.m., I get up at 7 a.m. and I'm like, ah, this is so boring. But then if I write at 1 p.m. that day, I'm like, oh, this feels different. So it really is, for me at least, variety and discipline and gentleness. And it's more of an and than an either or on any of those things, which feels very non-binary now that I've said it out loud.
Oh, totally. And not adhering to any rules. That's what I love both about what you're describing and also being genderqueer.
Yes.
And I was a personal trainer years and years ago. And something that was so hard for my clients to do was cardio. And I used to say, I don't care what type it is. Choose the one that has least resistance for you. If that's treadmill, great. If that's elliptical, great. If that's playing an hour of basketball, great. And I have thought about that a lot regarding my own writing process, where it's like, yeah, I could be strict about it and be up at 7, but sitting in that chair, I know I'm going to burn a couple hours being like, I don't want to do this. And so I just sort of, when I'm in that headspace, like, no, I think I could knock out a paragraph, or I think I could do half an outline. That's when I do. And it doesn't matter what time of the day it is. I just, you know, try to do it. Now, obviously my life is shifting outside of my work because I've got a family and, you know, that takes a certain amount of time and effort. So I have to be a bit more structured and sneak in time here and there, but, you know, it's just being adaptable is the key.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think you, or at least you're right for me. Well, that's maybe a little bit stronger. I'm not asking you out right now, at least. I just mean what you're saying is what's right for me. I'm like, and this is the portion of the podcast where I flirt with you. You know, maybe, I don't know. We'll see what happens. But, you know, Jeremy, I didn't expect us to get so much into writing philosophy to kick things off, though it makes me so excited. And it really, now I'm like, oh my gosh, I wonder how Gatsby came together in these different ways. But, you know, I think I'd like to sort of start talking about Gatsby, if that's okay with you.
Totally.
For our listeners who may not know, Gatsby is the graphic novel written by Jeremy Holt, with illustrations by Felipe Guinea, colors by Dier Bakeli, letters by Adam Woollett. And it is a retelling, I'm just going to say for now, but we're going to trouble that notion. But it's a retelling of The Great Gatsby. It has a beautiful foreword by Billy Porter that we have to talk to about at some point. And it is just this delightful graphic novel that I hope everyone will read. It came out in June of this year, I believe. Is that right, Jeremy?
That's correct.
Okay, great. And, you know, I, before I even let you say anything, I think because I called it a retelling, I gotta say for listeners, you know, it's really a retelling, but it's actually a reinvention, which is so fitting for a story of a man who is creating himself out of his own will, his own vision, his own imagination. And, you know, you talk about the idea of reinvention versus retelling, Jeremy, a little bit in your afterword. And I'm curious if, you know, now that it's been out for just a little bit and it's no longer in your hands, no longer an idea in your brain, I'm curious how that idea is sitting with you now, the idea of reinvention, especially when it comes to Gatsby.
Well, I was a late bloomer to the book. I didn't actually read it until 2017. So I was quite taken aback by it when I read it, because I was surprised, pleasantly surprised, with how relevant some of these themes felt to me, especially the one about reinvention and the American dream. And the first thing that came to mind after I'd finished it was really something that my mom, advice she gave me as a young child, which sort of, when I read the first words of chapter one of the book, is in the same vein where, you know, the Nick character is getting advice from his father. And she said, this is the time to reinvent yourself. You can be whoever you want. And she would say that because we moved a lot. My family moved a lot because of my dad's job as an engineer. So I was never really living anywhere for more than a few years. And so she just would say, this is the time to reinvent yourself. So I look back on that advice and realize I never took her up on it and I never had the courage to do it. And so to read about a character who not only does it, but embodies it and believes it and, you know, creates, crafts this whole life around magical thinking was really, it felt like a really nice fantasy. And I was working on a different project at the time. I was writing a novel around a serial killer that I had made up. And so it was a very abrupt shift I made where I was like, I'm going to work on this instead. And so the genesis of it was a prose young adult novel that I had written, but I can freely admit that it wasn't very good. And I liked it enough, the concept of it. And I realized I hadn't pushed it far enough as far as sort of what am I trying to say by reimagining this text?
Mm.
And it felt more like the novel version felt more like fanfic, to be honest. So I decided to retool it for a graphic novel. And I just had missed the collaborative nature of making comics. Writing novels is very, it's a lot of solitude. And so I decided to reread the book again and then look at it as a blueprint. And there were key narrative touchstones that had to happen, key character arcs that had to happen. And so using that, I realized this could be more fun if I reinvent them by making the entire cast younger, because I personally love teen dramas, like as far back as like Beverly Hills 90210, Dawson's Creek, The O.C., Gossip Girl. And I wanted to kind of write a story in that vein because I love that genre of TV. And so that's really was the ultimate genesis of it when I started working on it.
I'm so happy to hear that, because I said to my partner, I was like, this is The Great Gatsby meets Gossip Girl, like in the best possible way, because I also love those shows. It's just so scandalous. Everything is so over the top and, you know, they're very soapy in a way that's so fun to watch. And I don't know, I think in a sort of at a higher level, they treat the lives of young people like they have value.
They have value, and they make the younger people, when you look at these shows, they're in reality, these are like 20 somethings playing 15-year-olds. So it sort of elevates the teenager archetype, yes, which is really interesting. And I've always wanted to think of myself as older. And I think that's ultimately why I gravitated to those types of shows.
That's so real. You know, you talked a little bit about how it was coming back from the sort of isolating novel writing process to going back into the collaborative nature of comics. And I feel like I want to hear more about that. So I would like to hear a little bit about what it was like to work with Cuenya. And he had said in his afterword, I believe, that you two had worked together on a shorter piece at one point, but then connected on Twitter about this specific project. I think in the wake of maybe you were sharing some rejections you'd gotten, and Cuenya was like, well, let's get rejected together. But I'd love to hear how things evolved from there and really generally what the process was like working specifically with him, but also with the wider creative team.
Yeah, Felipe and I go way back in the sense of having met, I'm going to say, almost a decade ago. And when I was starting out in around 2008, 2009, it took me maybe a couple of years to develop relationships with other comic book writers. And once I had found sort of my small cohort, they had, you know, these rosters of artists on standby for projects they were thinking of or were currently in production with. And a friend of mine, my friend Ryan Ferrier, who unfortunately just quit comics several years ago, was very talented at it. He had Felipe on his roster and he said, hey, I've worked with this guy. He's great. Maybe, you know, you have something for him. And so what Felipe had referenced in the afterword was a 10-page short for an anthology that has yet to see the light of day. But it was a fun project. And I just kind of kept watching him over the years. And I just watched his attention to detail and his speed just increase with every passing year. So when it came time to start looking for somebody to do a pitch, basically, you know, 6 to 10 pages of completed art that I needed to try to find a new literary agent, because I'd at the time let my first one go. I knew that he could draw the things I needed. I needed someone who could draw a car. I needed the car to look like a Range Rover. I needed a house to look like a fancy mansion, or I needed an iPhone to look like an iPhone, because the story is very grounded in a very real reality in a present day Long Island. So yeah, I pitched it to him, and he was fortunately had just finished up something. He said great timing, and he knocked out, I think it was like 8 pages. And I had met Gerbla years ago through my friend Declan Shalvey and Jordi Belair, when they were both, I was in Ireland just for a trip, and they both were living there at the time, and they invited me out to dinner. And that's where I met Derpa. And I had always kept them in mind for a project. And so it kind of all worked out timing-wise. And yeah, I mean, even with the team assembled, it got rejected like left and right to the point where I basically gave up on it and I moved on to other things. So it wasn't until another book I had done that had been published before Gatsby, a book called Made in Korea that came out through Image Comics, which really was, and in a lot of ways, still the best, one of the best things I've written, because I just wove my own personal narratives, some of my trauma into that book. And it was because of the visibility of Image that the CCO of AWA Studios, Axel Alonso, who I know by reputation, reached out to me, and he wanted my phone number. He reached out to me through Twitter, and I was like, oh, yeah, sure. And I had more or less given up. My agent had attempted to try to sell it for almost a year and a half, and it sort of seemed dead in the water. And I happened to be at my grandmother's funeral when Axel gave me a call, and I looked at my phone. I was like, oh my God, this is Axel Alonso. Like, I can't not answer this. So I had to politely excuse myself. And we ended up on a call for about an hour and a half, mostly talking about Made in Korea. And then at the end of it, he said, what else do you have? And I said, I have this thing nobody wants. It's about Gatsby. And he said, send it to me. And then within a month, we were signed and we were off to the races making the book.
Wow. Wow. What a life this book has had. I mean, to be like, you assembled your super team, like, and then in crickets for a year and a half, and then things just turn around. I mean, wow. Are you tired? Are you like, how are you doing? Like, how do you feel? Like, what a roller coaster.
It's, I mean, I have books that have taken longer to see publication. I mean, Made in Korea, I think took about 6 years. Virtually Yours, which was a book I did through Comixology Originals. I got published, printed through Dark Horse. That took 7-8 years.
Okay, so you're like, you know, this is how it goes sometimes.
Well, it's like, I just think no good idea dies. A good idea, just, it's not the right time.
I'm going to have to write that down and put it over my desk so I can like remember that. That's well, it's good,
like,
Jeremy.
It's like when you're sifting for gold, right? You know, the panhandlers of the early 20th century sifting for gold. There's a lot of stuff that breaks loose that is worthless. And with enough time and patience, gold will emerge. And it's those things that, those ideas that don't leave me, those ideas that I think I'm going to revisit that. And this happened to be one of those things that kind of hit me very suddenly out of nowhere. And I, even though the world of publishing was saying, no, thank you, I knew that if anyone asked what I was working on, that was the first thing I was going to bring up. Because I felt that I was doing something with the text that I had not seen before, which was writing it for a modern day audience and updating it for the American dream that I see, and what that dream means to me as a person of color, as a queer person. And so I knew that I had something, because it was being written for my personal lived experiences, that no one else was going to have it. So I was always ready to pitch it to somebody. And I'm just grateful that Axel took a chance on me.
I am too, because I love this book. Okay, so I have one more question about the art while we're kind of near that topic still. You know, the art manages to be at once timeless, modern, and especially with the colors from Kelly, Derba Kelly, evocative of the other Roaring Twenties, not the one we're currently living through, the other one. How much of that was a conversation with Kuenya and Kelly? How much of that was just what they were bringing to the page? And does it hit that same sort of good feeling spot for you as the creator to now see it in that beautiful, bold color?
This was a little different for me regarding the production. With most of my creator-owned books, I am sort of the project manager. And so when AWA took us on, there was much more of a hands-off approach. Like, I was just responsible for my end of it, which was the scripts. And I really didn't see a lot of the art while it was getting made. So I would get batches every once in a while. So the color specifically was a series of conversations that Axel had with Derbla. So it really, I do give credit to Axel for having that vision about trying to evoke the Roaring Twenties as opposed to the 2020s. And so it was really nice to actually see the difference in the colors and the art that we had done for the pitch, to see it revised for what is now on shelves, because Felipe actually went back and redid every single page of that pitch because he said my style in the year and a half, 2 years since I did those has evolved. And I said, great, if you don't mind redoing those, have at it. And so that was nice because it did provide some continuity between his current style and what he was doing a couple of years back. So it was just kind of, I mean, this is what I love about comics is that when you get those pages, it feels like Christmas. It's like, oh my God. And having spent so much time on these projects and it takes so much time for them to maybe even see the light of day, it's very common for me to have this sort of disorienting experience where I look at a series of pages and I go, I wrote that? That's pretty good. Like, it's like I'm reading something for the first time. I'm like, wow, that's a nice little twist. Oh, go me. And it's partly because of my process, because I saved dialogue for absolute last, because my mistake early on was I got so hung up on dialogue, and dialogue could wreck my process for days, if not weeks, just trying to get this right line of dialogue to play out. Because to me, dialogue has to feel like a song. It has to have a certain rhythm and pace to it. And so I decided to shelve the dialogue to the end, and I will make notes during the writing process. But the goal and the purpose of that is to focus on what I'm describing in the panel descriptions, because early on, I wasn't focusing on that. And so artists would come back to me and be like, I don't really understand what's happening here. And in theory, if I write a good script, the artist should be able to draw it without any dialogue. So, but the side effect of that is I don't really remember some of the conversations these characters have, which is kind of weird.
The creative process. Yeah. Wow. That's really cool. Thank you so much for sharing, especially how it was a little bit different, because that does seem like a very different process than a lot of the creator-owned projects I've heard about. So very cool. I mean, wow. Axel certainly got your vision and certainly brought everything together in like a really beautiful way. And this creative team is just like all superstars. Everybody did an amazing job on it. It is just so delightful to read. And again, like you really do feel like you're somehow in modern day, but also roaring 20s Long Island. And that's the best to me possible way of doing a reimagination of something is to not just scrap the original material, save the name, which could be tempting, but to really, you know, deal with those deeper themes and pieces that maybe even at the time, you know, couldn't have been grappled with because of who was creating it. And that, you know, that brings me to something that you've mentioned a couple times, the American Dream. And I didn't have a question specifically about that, but I think that this question I have is connected. So you'll tell me if it is. And I just can't wait to hear what you have to say. You know, I've been thinking a lot about how Lou and his novel counterpart, Nick Carraway, are the symbol of the insider-outsider, or maybe, you know, what it's like to be near a world that you're not actually fully part of. You're sort of this voyeur with a backstage pass, maybe. And that's part of, I think, what Lou and Nick both see in Gatsby is that same sort of insider-outsider, though you know, it takes the novel and obviously your graphic novel as well, a little bit of time to get to that part because, you know, they're introducing us to who Gatsby is through that lens that Lou has. But, you know, that theme is heightened in my mind through references to how, you know, there's Singaporean wealth and everyone from Singapore must be rich. And the book Crazy Rich Asians is brought up a couple times, both in the art and in dialogue. And then, you know, also Gatsby talking about what it means for him to be a Black and gay man and how that changes his insider-outsider status with this group of people. And it made me think, you know, to some degree, I wonder if queerness itself, non-binariness itself, can be sort of that insider-outsider status, especially because, you know, there's so many other kinds of insider-outsider dynamics inside of our communities, right? Like white people and people of color, fat people, thin people, able-bodied folks, disabled folks, you know, like all kinds of different pieces, different ways that power is working and how we get to be insider outsider. Originally, I was going to ask like, well, why did that theme jump out at you? But now I'm thinking, you know, it's probably connected somehow to the American Dream part that we were talking about. So I guess I just, you know, if I'm anywhere in a realm of like, yes, that piqued interest, go. If not, I can like formulate a question, I promise.
No, that's really a nice observation. I wasn't actually looking at it. I didn't connect my feelings about the American Dream with queerness, but I do see the relevance and sort of the connective tissue between the two. It's the insider-outsider was the feeling I got reading the original text. However, because Nick is a cishet white man, he's not outside in that regard. And to me, it sort of always felt short for me because it was just about money. which at the time was interesting. And at the time Fitzgerald was writing it, was on people's minds. However, for me, I thought, how do I push every single theme I want to explore further? And for me, you know, having Lou be an outsider, both financially and culturally, I thought was more interesting. And because the America I see and the America that is becoming is more diverse. And I thought that that was a very important statement I also wanted to make. And it also tied in with reinvention was, you know, how does Gatsby make his wealth? Well, in the book, he's this, you know, independently wealthy man, but he also secretly is a bootlegger. And so I thought, well, the bootlegging still works in my narrative. It just has to be the dark web, but let's have him make a social media company. And so I specifically chose a social media company because that in and of itself is all about reinvention. It's about creating a version of yourself you want the world to see. And I wanted all the characters to have the power of reinvention, not just the Gatsby character. And so for me, with my own journey with my gender identity, the best way I described it, and actually made my therapist laugh recently, where I said, it's like at the end of The Matrix, when Neo sees all the code, it's like the code is this heteronormative script we've all been raised within. And for every single queer person that finds their way out of it or is cast out of it, however they find themselves, they're no longer flowing with that current. And you get to pause and go, how do I want to proceed? Which direction do I want to go? And what I've always truly loved and found so liberating about being non-binary is that I can go in any direction I want, whenever I want. And so that's really kind of part of why I wanted to explore these characters from a more racially diverse, culturally diverse story.
I mean, and gender diverse, right? Like two of our main characters are non-binary in the story. And I, you know, that really, it touched me to see exactly as you're describing the diversity of the world we live in, you know, with Black characters and Singaporean characters and, you know, white characters and queer characters and non-binary characters. And it just really felt, it feels very relevant in a way that I think I too struggle to relate to the Great Gatsby narrative. I guess maybe because, you know, some of my friends will hear this and like laugh, but like maybe because my mom was such an amazing scam artist. So like I see a scammer from a mile away, you know what I mean? And I'm like, well, Gatsby's a scammer, you know what I mean? Like no part of me is like, wow, how compelling. But then I read your Gatsby and I'm like, okay, now this Gatsby is very compelling.
Like, well, what's interesting for me anyway was that 2017 was a very monumentally pivotal moment for me because it was, I had two major realizations about my life as a writer. One, and this ties into my identity. I'm a Korean American. I'm adopted. I was raised by white parents. And what often happens in that dynamic is that there is this color blindness that occurs. And that color blindness comes in the message of we don't see color, which can be very confusing for the development of a transracial kid because you are essentially told that we don't see color, so the world doesn't see color, when that is in fact not true. And what ends up happening is that I viewed myself as white for most of my life. One of my earliest memories about this was, I must have been maybe 8 or 9, and I caught my reflection in the mirror. And my reflection to me was like spotting a celebrity, like you recognize the person, but you know nothing about them. And it was disorienting, but I never really dwelled on it. I never thought about why am I feeling this way. So flash forward to 2017, when I came out as non-binary, I also realized all the work I'd been producing up until that point was white male savior stories for two reasons. One, I thought that was my narrative and I thought that's what readers wanted. And I was finding very little success and it was an uphill battle, that pushing the boulder up the hill kind of thing. And when I decided to stop doing that and focus on myself and think about the stories that resonate with me and are more authentic to my journey, that's when I started looking at what I was working on and started infusing color into it in a myriad of ways. And I think what's great about that is the writing advice I think every writer gets is write what you know. And I've really never liked that advice because it presumes that what I know is interesting. And I don't assume anything I know is interesting. And it took me years to unpack it. And what has been helpful for me is write what you've survived. Because when you do that, you are writing from a very authentic place that is uniquely your own, because we all have unique experiences that cannot be duplicated. And when you write from that place, you don't really ever have to worry about someone stealing your ideas. And it was those very authentic pieces of myself that I wove into my books, starting with Virtually Yours, then Made in Korea, and now Gatsby, where these stories were resonating with editors and readers on a level that all of my other books combined weren't even generating. So it's been a really great eye-opening experience post-2017 for me.
Wow. I am I am moved by Write What You Survive. That is, I think that that describes a lot of what, you know, in my own experience, my writing that has had a lot of traction with people. I think you're absolutely correct. I'd never thought of it that way, but you're right that like those, no one else can write that, right? Like that is such a great point. And also that, you know, maybe more so than ever before, like a lot of people are in pain at the same time reading the same things. I think people have been in pain throughout history, but we're all reading similar things for once. And I think that's a beautiful, it's not just beautiful in the sense of like, wow, to heal yourself, but to maybe heal yourself, maybe just explore your pain, who knows, but also as this sort of this invitation to your readers to,
yeah,
to engage with that survival as well.
I think it's radical to love yourself. I think it's radical to love, to just show love in the face of resistance or even hate. It's a hard thing to do. It's an easy thing to understand as a concept. It's sometimes for me impossible to implement in practice. Because with my own gender identity journey, you know, my family wasn't super supportive of it, didn't understand it. And that lack of understanding created very defensive conversations, which has just been really disappointing. And it's not that I love them less. It's just I understand the importance of a boundary. A good example of this is like when I started writing Virtually Yours, it was a romantic comedy because I love that genre as well. And the original story was very white focused, very white centric. And when I decided to just revamp everything I was working on, that was the first project I went to. And I changed all the characters, literally changed all their ethnicities. And there's only one white character in it. And it was a completely different story instantly. And I was going through and had gone through a very messy divorce. And, you know, just the realization that I was in an abusive marriage was something really hard to grapple with. But for some reason, I thought, I'm going to just write this in. One of the main characters is going through a really nasty divorce, and it's not the woman. And I wanted to show that men or AMAB or however you identify can be abused just as much as women. And that is talked about less. And I did a certain amount of research on it, and it's just not something talked about. And I thought, this is not really going to fly with publishers because it's why would you write a domestic violence story into a romantic comedy? But I got it published. And honestly, the people that have interviewed me about it, that is the one thing they all gravitate towards. And they ask, I don't know why it works, but it does. Why did you go that route? Or, you know, male podcast hosts have spoken to me off the air saying, I went through something similar. I've never seen this visibility before. Thank you for writing that. And that's really what it is. It's about visibility, both for me as an Asian person and as a queer person.
Well, and I think you're, in that specific instance, our understanding, we talk about this sometimes on the pod because we got a lot of survivors on the team at BOC. You know, we so often, the image of what abuse is it's a battered woman. I'm using that term specifically, a battered wife. And it's a cis hetero scenario. And that's all people can really think about when they think about intimate partner violence.
Yeah.
But queer intimate partner violence is extremely important to talk about because people so often are so ashamed that they could be a bad queer person or bring bad attention to the community. And that's, you know, we have to talk about that. And we also have to talk about what does it look like in, you know, diverse communities? What does it look like in Black communities? What does it look like in Korean communities? It's all very different, right? Like we think it's all going to be this, you know, we really, again, we only think of the white, to be frank, battered wife. And that is absolutely a demographic that is deeply impacted by intimate partner violence, but men are abused. The taller, larger partner is abused sometimes, regardless of their gender. It yeah. isn't about physical strength, right? It's, I believe pretty strongly that physical abuse is a manifestation of emotional abuse. It is an extension of that desire to control, belittle, to make someone smaller.
Definitely.
And I think that's just, it's so important to show more faces of that. And so I haven't had a chance to read Virtually Yours though, but I am now like it's top of my list because obviously that's, I'm deeply invested in narratives of survivors and narratives of, you know, how do we create a new life when someone we gave everything to told us we were worthless? How do you create worth for yourself? I think that's really incredible. So Yeah, I mean, I think when you say representation, you're dead on. And it doesn't feel like the sort of, you know, by now it's a cliche. Do I still believe representation matters? I do, but it is a cliche at this point that representation matters. But you're taking it so much further than like, oh, so we'll just like drop whoever in these different, you know, like we'll just make some people Black and then we'll just in our stories and we'll just make some people Korean in our stories. We'll just make some people Chinese in our, you know, it's like, no, they actually have to be real lived in characters. And that's what I hear you talking about as well.
And that's really the focus when I was writing a rom-com, because I've watched so many of them. I understand the formula. And specifically with the gay best friend, that character is so important to me because in most cinema and TV, this person doesn't have a life. They are just the comedic relief. And it's like, I'm always curious, like, well, what does that character do for a living? What is their relationships like other than just servicing their best friend? And that was something that I focused on with Virtually Yours. And I just felt that, you know, it was actually the impetus to do all of that with that story was one of my editors, I had sent the pitch to him and he ultimately passed on it, but he gave me some really good advice. And he said, you know, you have these really great concepts, you have really great story, but the thing that I see that happens quite often for you is you don't let your characters fall. And like, this is a good example where you got to fuck them up. You got to let them hit the ground hard because they can't get up if they don't fall. So, you know, just, you know, you walk them to the edge, but then you pull them back and it's, in a way it's not very satisfying. And I said, oh. So then my brain went into this thought of like, what is a fall? And I thought, well, I was sort of having a fall out of a relationship. And I said, hey, that's interesting. And I was like, I don't think anyone wants to read about this. But I was like, you know what? This happened to me. I can't be the only one. So by just writing it in, maybe someone else will feel seen. And it was a complicated thing to work through because, like you said, the archetype of domestic abuse is this one very specific example. And it was alarming to me how many people, close friends I spoke to about it after the fact, sort of also fed into that narrative. And even it took me years to acknowledge because it wasn't that concept playing out in real time for me. It was different things, but it was still straight up abuse. And so I remember something that was so jarring for me was I told a close friend of mine that, you know, oh yeah, she hit me when I was sleeping. And this was a time when I was not out as non-binary. I was very much, as far as I was concerned, cishet, he, him. And my friend said, well, how hard can a woman hit? And it was really shocking to me because it's like, that's not even the point. And it's like, it's about consent. And to have to explain consent to men is very frustrating. Straight men, it's very frustrating. And so I look at all of the things that have happened to me in those types of contexts. And what I've learned is that they're gifts. They're gifts for me because they forced me out of that cis heteronormative stream, that current. And I'm so lucky that I got cast out for my own reasons, because I know myself well enough that I could have just kept going with the flow. And I'm glad that I don't have to, because living authentically is like an absolute joy. And I wish more people would lean into it, understand for themselves what that authenticity is for themselves. Because you just, I don't know, you're just happier. And when you're happier, your relationships around you thrive.
Hell yeah.
So, yeah. And I think that with fiction, it's a really good example of like any writer, you know, the best thing you can do is write about your pain and weave it into your narrative as deep as you have to so you don't feel too exposed. But that's sort of the luxury, is that you can weave it into fiction. And people just say, hey, that feels real, because it is.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's such a real point. I'm also an editor. And so often what I work with is exactly what your editor described to you, that desire to walk someone up to the edge of pain and then pull them back, because we love our characters and we love people and we're kind. Most of us don't really want to torture other humans. I'm going to go out on a limb and say most of us. I'm going to do it. I'm going to say most. And so it's hard when it comes to writing, because you have to create someone you love so much or want to spend time with so much. You don't have to actually like them. And then you have to make their life hell. And it's hard to do, I think, especially when you've survived really hard things, because it's like, well, I would never want someone to go through what I went through. But I think you hit the nail on the head. When we take fictional characters through those dark experiences, those hard experiences, those times we didn't want to wake up the next day, if we have the courage to do that and do it well, we offer so many people a lifeline, truly, of how do you live beyond this horrible thing? And I think that's a real valid question lots of people have.
Yeah.
listeners. It's me, your beloved SE, back to tell you about something that maybe you don't know about yet that you might want to take advantage of. Did you know we're active over on Patreon? We're at a new address. It's patreon.com/queerspec. If you go to patreon.com/bitchesoncomics, it still redirects there for the time being. But we're at patreon.com/queerspec. And we have just so many episodes. We have over 100 back episodes, and we're constantly coming out with new stuff. We have these amazing conversations where Priya, our editorial coordinator, and Sarah Sentry, one of our hosts, sit down and talk about the Phoenix Saga. They call these episodes the Bitches of X. They are fucking incredible, and I hope you will tune in. You also typically get early access to our episodes each week. And other fun stuff. We've done Christmas bonuses. We do interviews that are only available on our Patreon. We provide all the inside scoops before you even know you need them. The whole shebang. We hope you'll join us there. Again, it's patreon.com/queerspec.
You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
I really do think there's just so much to that idea of working from the place of your pain and putting that into your stories. You know, I'm curious for you, what's the balancing factor of that, right? Because we don't write to do therapy, but there are therapeutic aspects of writing, right? So like, when is it a story, and how do you turn something like that into a story without it just being like maybe all of your baggage on the page? Or do you just put all your baggage on the page? I don't know.
I think that's a great question. What I've learned in my own therapy journey is that there's intent versus impact, and then there's reaction and response. And it's taken me a considerable amount of effort, time, patience with myself to get to the latter of those two and to understand the latter. You know, we might have the best intent, but we cannot ignore the impact, and we have to take accountability for impact, which I rarely see people talk about. And I see that as a missed opportunity in a lot of narratives I watch, both through film and TV. And as far as the react and respond, when I start writing about these things, I am not venting. I am not in a reactionary headspace. I'm not vindictive. I'm not, you know, just the ego at play kind of thing. I'm collected. I've grounded myself. And I think about, what do I want to explore? And ultimately, what is this saying about the scenario? Because, it, you know, what is the takeaway? And I think more about from that perspective, what do I want someone to walk away with from this scene or this conversation between these two characters? Because it's optics, really. And so it can be sometimes more challenging than others, depending on the topic. But I think that's, you know, with, I tend to have these scenarios, these harder hitting things that are from lived experience happen a bit later in the story, because I want the reader to be invested in the characters. So when I take them for a loop, take the reader for a loop, they're sort of prepared because they are strapped in and they want to see how this ends for these characters.
Mm.
And I'm delighted when people read books like Virtually Yours or Made in Korea and I did not see that coming. And it's like, it just gripped me. And it's like, great, because that was by design. Like, I want to do this sort of misdirection where I'm going to play on your assumptions based on the gender of the character, based on the conversations, based on the scenario. And I'm going to weave in my truths that defy convention, because that's where I want to live within. And I don't do it a lot because it can be very disorienting for a reader, but I just want to crack that door a bit and just, you know, fuck convention and show that there is another way to view this very sensitive topic.
Mm. I'm so glad you said that, because it actually is bringing me back to a question I had before I went off on that tangent we cut from the episode. But it has to do with that idea of having the sort of lived experiences that kind of kick you out of the gender binary and out of cishet society. And I've got a question. It's in here somewhere. I'm going to find it. But, you know, I was thinking a lot about how I've heard other people say this, and it really resonated with me. Like, oh, I was a failed man. And you told me I was a failed man so many times. And I finally agreed with you. So I'm non-binary. But now you're mad at me. You're mad at me for agreeing with you that I failed at this performance that you thought was important, but I obviously don't. And I think that piece, that rejection as kind of liberation, that it does crack open the world, as you were just describing, trying to do for your readers. I don't know. There's something beautiful in that, something that feels very organic, and not organic in like the sense of like meant to be, but more organic in the sense of like the way that nature is, you know, where sometimes, you know, the flower has to be broken open to drop its seeds, right? Like sometimes some flowers, botanists don't come at me, you know, like that kind of piece of like, There is some destruction capacity, or capacity is not even the right word. I'm obviously struggling with an inchoate idea, but the sort of destruction, liberation, not even dichotomy, but like the sort of ways they're connected. And I'm curious if anything I'm saying resonates at all with you, if you're like, you know what, cut it. It makes no sense.
No, I think that like looking at what comes to mind immediately is my long career in IT. So I started my career at Apple. I started as like a specialist, a salesperson on the floor, working a graveyard shift at their Fifth Avenue flagship location in 2006, where I was coming at 7 p.m., leaving at 4 a.m. because those doors have stayed open since they opened. It's a 24-hour, 365 type of place. And once I eventually got certified and became a technician or a genius, the whole job for me, it was very repetitive, but it was also taking this skill set of disassembling a machine down to its chassis, down to its components, and then rebuilding it, replacing things that need to be fixed, isolating the problem, figuring out what needed to be taken out. And for me, I do that a lot with my own life when it comes to conflict. And for me, it's looking at all the things, the baggage in my mind, and unpacking it and going through it and go, is this serving me? Nope. Is that serving me? Yeah, I'll hold on to that. But it takes effort. It takes mental bandwidth to do. And it takes practice to do it regularly, because neural pathways are hard to carve because we already have so many established ones. And so for me, it's with any kind of story, I'm just like holding it up like a little Rubik's cube and like looking at all surfaces of it and going, how can I shift this? How can I change this? How can I modify it? What works for this? What doesn't? What is getting in the way? And I think being in the practice of that can be applied both creatively, personally, and it's to me, helps check the ego, because I'm often having to play devil's advocate with myself. For example, like a conflict with a sibling, and I could get defensive and I could live in that reactionary head state, or I could take a beat, take some breaths and go, okay, what do I need to take accountability for here? Because no one's 100%. And once I start to see, oh yeah, okay, I slipped up there, miscommunication or lack of communication or whatever, and just kind of try to repair. And that's really what it is you're breaking something apart and you want to repair it. And the wanting to repair is the greatest life skill anyone can learn, both emotionally, even physically.
I love that. I love that. Wow, we've been like all over. I have more questions about Gatsby, so I'm going to take us back there. But you know, we'll weave back around. I'm sure we'll come back to like all the great philosophies that we have that will, you know, fix the world. And then, you know, at the end of the call, we'll be like, all right, here you go, everybody. Here's how to fix the world. Good luck. Yeah. JK. So, you know, we talked a little bit about in your book, Gatsby is this, you know, social media mogul who's both running a legal and like an illicit app, which is pretty fun. That's a fun dynamic to play with. But generally, social media plays like a pretty big role in the narrative. You know, sometimes we'll see posts that Lou has made, or we'll sort of have like, you know, a ping will happen in the background and someone's getting a text, which I guess is like not technically social media, but you know what, for today, I'm going to say it is. And it's used really in the narrative. It feels very real, very modern in the way that social media is such a big piece of how we connect with the world today, for better or worse, probably for worse, but you know, for better or worse. You know, it gives a sense of both like, oh, realism, but then in this other piece, this ubiquity and almost panopticon that Gatsby has erected. Of Gatsby uses the social media app to find where Lou is. That's a little creepy. Gatsby's like, oh yeah, that's something we built into it. I believe it's geotagging. And it's like, oh wow, okay. That's real, right? Like that's not, you didn't make that up. That's a real thing that happens with social media. And so it ends up being this mirror back to the reader, I think, where, you know, people can, I mean, it's like when those scary things happen where someone like says like, I'm going to take a video, and they take a video and someone's like, well, I can tell you where you are exactly, you know, mm-hmm. and they use the search function and the maps and whatever. And they're like, oh, you're at this gas station in Texas. And it's like, what? I hate that. But you know, I think that ubiquity, that panopticon, that constantly being surveyed, like that's real, right? That's the society we live in. And I want to know, you know, with the way you've specifically stylized it, played it up, and then made it such a central plot point, the fact that Gatsby is the head of these sort of two different apps with very different purposes. What is it you're trying to say about social media, especially at this moment in time, right? As we're watching arguably the biggest social media app that has ever existed, you know, fall apart before our eyes. Like what is, and you know what, you were writing it in 2017. So maybe you didn't mean it to be a commentary about this. Now I'm thinking about it, but now that we're at this point, what do you think that social media part means? And also what were you trying to do originally?
I think from a larger standpoint, it's about technology, right? And if you step back from that, it's intent versus impact. And I think the Google search engine is a very good example of this, where the intent was very good to help improve and make your search on the internet more intuitive. However, the impact is that it has completely changed our perception of reality, because you and I could be sitting next to each other, and based on our search histories, the top queries would be different. And that is the reflection to us what the world looks like. And so I know people at Google who have admitted like, yeah, the genie's out of the bottle. There's no way of going back from that. And now we're just trying to learn as we go. And that's sort of with the advent of the internet, this pace of how things move, there's all this good intent and there's been horrible impact. And when I was doing research for Made in Korea, I had, which is about an Android child, I had attended this lecture about a professor was talking about AI, and specifically with Mattel, which I thought was very interesting. And apparently Mattel had produced these Barbie dolls that had some basic AI. They could speak back via voice prompts with the kid, with the owner. But these conversations were being logged and saved and uploaded to a cloud. And the data was reflecting that there were kids confessing to their dolls of abuse in the home. And so the question became, who owns the data? And nobody really has an answer for it. Because again, the intent was good to create these interactive dolls, but the impact has much larger ramifications. And that's sort of what I was doing with this as well, because there's such a technology, such a big component to the narrative, where Gatsby has this intent. And I'm trying to make him this as much as I can an ethical CEO of a social media company. But the fact that he's also running the dark web, he is that dichotomy of his personality, of his character, but also just there's some baked in hypocrisy, which I think is kind of hard to avoid with how fast technology moves. And I wanted to, you know, the struggle with the Gatsby character was to still make him likable. Because to be honest, the original text, there's really nothing about him that is likable. And even there's a passage in it that Nick finds him detestable. And so I was very conscious of trying to make him seem like on your side, like your friend, which was a challenge.
Well, and I think one of the ways for me, at least, you know, as a queer person, that worked was him talking about what it was like to be gay and Black, and him talking about first meeting. And of course, I've completely forgotten Lou's cousin's name.
Tommy.
I don't know how. Say again.
Tommy, like Tom Buchanan. I use most of the names from the original book.
Oh, so like the book. Got it. Okay. So Tommy, now I'm like, duh, Tommy, right?
But could you imagine Tom Buchanan in Fitzgerald's version being called Tommy? Like, no.
No, I really couldn't. I really couldn't. Old Tom. Yeah, I mean, I think part of the way that it is that sort of, we get to see them so young, you know, we get this flashback to when they're 14, I think, and mm-hmm. and Gatsby and Tommy first meet. And it's just, I guess that innocence, that vulnerability, I think really does make us feel like, wow, this is someone who's a little bit more relatable. I think also because he's not like making Tommy like hate his ex-fiance, you know, he's not like he's not controlling Tommy the same way that it feels like Gatsby is Daisy in the novel. So I think that definitely helps with the likability. But really, I think too, he feels like a dreamer who is trying to do something really cool and resorts to other means to make that happen, including the dark web piece. And it's like, to some degree, you can empathize with that, right? Like, I've written tons of freelance work for big corporations. And I mean, I definitely feel like that's an ethical gray area. You know? Like, but I need money. So here we are. So I guess I empathize a little bit more with this Gatsby because it feels a little bit more means to an end, which, you know, is obviously something, you know, my partner's not here. I don't have to talk about that right now. Whenever I say means to an end, we have to have like a 20-minute conversation about how the means are the ends. And I'm like, yes, I know. Anyways. But, you know, I think that's part of what makes this Gatsby so likable. I mean, also the character design. He looks so cool.
Yeah. That was, I have to give full credit to Felipe. Our visual reference that I had given him is the musician Moses Sumney.
Mm.
So Moses has been the visual representation, even though I think he does look a bit too old for the book, but it was just kind of a reference, really. But also just the fact that, you know, yes, the dark web is sort of analogous to bootlegging of the 1920s, but also no one has really mentioned this, but, you know, making him Black was intentional because the fact that he has to break the rules essentially and go outside the bounds of essentially normal commerce. Like, yes, he has a social media app that is sort of a vanity project, but what really got his riches was this dark web and the fact that, you know, unless you're white, you don't have access to these things. And he had to basically carve his own path. And I think that says a lot about his character, but also it's a bit of a commentary on just the socioeconomic politics of not being white.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That makes perfect sense to me. I think that's the other piece, right? It's like, it feels a little bit like, I loved when you at the beginning of the episode, or maybe not, maybe the middle, I'm not sure, you had said, you know, like, I just didn't find Nick that compelling because he was like a little bit less rich.
Yeah, just a little bit.
He's like, I went to Yale, but I'm so poor. And you're like, that's not, you're,
I don't think you know what poor
broker
means.
Like, what are you? You live in a beautiful carriage house on like a beautiful coast. Shut up. Like, I don't want to hear it, Nick. You know, I think that that's a piece too, is it does feel like, well, and then, you know, and then we're supposed to be like, oh, Gatsby was poor. And then he bootlegged his way to the top. And now we should be like, oh, wow. Again, it's like, okay. Yes. And I'm not that into it. But this, you know, this way, especially when you think about the race component, when you think about the fact that, I mean, he was like working on a dock when they met. He was working on, Gatsby in your graphic novel was working on a dock when he met Tommy. And yeah. Tommy was like one of the wealthy people bringing, I believe, his catamaran. I recently learned what a catamaran is. Bringing his catamaran up to the dock at a 14 and being like, oh, here's the rope, you know, just yeah. being like a little prince, which is like what he was in a way with his wealth. I mean, that disparity is so different, and it makes the whole thing, I don't know, it doesn't feel so frivolous. The Great Gatsby feels frivolous to me sometimes. I'm like, I don't know who I'm supposed to relate to in this. I don't understand what anyone's problems are. They're just like fucking and drinking and doing drugs. And that sounds like a good time. So I don't understand why they're all so sad.
Yeah, I think from what I feel, having read the text a few times over, it's this excess. I think that was the main point Fitzgerald was trying to capture, was this excess lifestyle and how it all felt like it was a house of cards, which at the time it was, because, you know, you have the market crash and within that decade. And
to be fair to Fitzgerald, I don't think he wants us to like any of the characters particularly.
You know, that's interesting, because I've also looked into, I've fallen down rabbit holes regarding the sort of the folklore behind the book.
Okay, tell me everything.
Well, there's enough evidence to suggest that he was taking passages from his wife's journals. And so, like, some have suggested that, you know, whole passages were completely lifted, and that, you know, at that time, you know, your wife's belongings were his belongings, his wife's belongings were his, and there was no sense of ownership, and like, and the entitlement was very high. So that's very interesting to consider.
Oh, that's good. I'm gonna have to sit with that. That's really interesting.
And also that there's enough language in it to strongly suggest that Gatsby was never coded to be white. In fact, there's enough evidence to strongly suggest that he was in fact not white and possibly black. So when the book was maybe 2 months out from release, The Atlantic had posted this pretty long, lengthy expose about this concept, about Gatsby's ethnicity. And there's enough academics in academia who have stated for years this case. And I was like, I'm glad I'm aware of it. And also something fun factoid was that when the book went into the public domain a year and a half ago, the USA Today had interviewed Fitzgerald's great-granddaughter and asked very pointedly, what do you hope people do with this now that it's available for everyone? And she's quoted saying, I would love someone to modernize this for a more diverse audience. And I was like, hey, that's exactly what I'm doing. So, you know, hold my beer kind of thing.
I mean, and like, I was telling my partner, I was like, you know, I like, this is my Gatsby. Like, this is Jeremy's Gatsby is my Gatsby. This is my Gatsby book. You know, this is the book that I would, when I think about that story, and I do think it has a lot of importance. I think we talked about so many of those themes, the insider outsider, the American dream, the reinvention of oneself, the, you know, especially heightened, it sounds like, even though, you know, now I'm hearing it was actually in the original text too, you know, the racial components, the class components, the, all those pieces. It really is the book that I'm going to think about, yours is, when I think about this work. And because, you know, the Gatsby's not going anywhere. It's part of the collective consciousness. It's going to show up in things forever. And that's cool. But I think it's extra cool because now I get to like think about your graphic novel when that happens, because that's going to be my main reference point. I really was moved by it. The art is exceptional. You have quite the creative team together. I love the cover. It's such a fun homage to that that old novel cover. Oh, there's one thing we haven't talked about that I have to before we go, which is the foreword by Billy Porter.
Yes.
Okay, I want to know how that came together, when you found out that was going to happen, how you feel about it. I want to know everything.
That was something that was discussed early on, about having someone give a foreword. I had thrown out a bunch of names, mainly, you know, big name comic book people I know. And I think the PR team was like, we need names, but you need to tell us what their follower counts are. So I gave a list of like 8 from people I know who have X amount of followers and down, from like, you know, 100,000 down. And yeah, you know, it was timing. They weren't available, which is fine. And, you know, they said, you know, what if we can get someone not in comics? I said, go for it. And so they orchestrated that entire thing, which was a surprise. And it was even a bigger surprise when I was asked, okay, can you send us a video of you asking Billy directly to do this? I said, is it going to get to him? They're like, yeah, we've confirmed it will go directly to him. Like, oh, okay. So I did this little video, it was like right before Christmas, and I sent it off. And then a few weeks later, they said, yeah, he's in. And I said, wait, he watched the video? They're like, oh yeah. And so it's even crazier that I had the fortune of just of meeting him in person this past summer. And that was for a completely different reason. I was at Tribeca Film Festival. I was invited as a jury member for their animated shorts competition. And so he happened to be there promoting his own things. And we had a lovely conversation, and it was the most surreal experience, because I'm standing here looking at this man that has been such an inspiration to me in so many ways. And I said, as a queer person, I just want to thank you for living so fiercely your truth. And, and this is why I wrote this book. And he very sort of paternally stroked my hair. And he said, I really appreciate that. Like, I've read this and I think it's beautiful. I think it's an amazing book. And he just gave me the biggest hug. And I was like, okay, don't cry.
Oh,
and it was just amazing.
Incredible. And just for listeners, I'm going to read just the last paragraph of Billy's foreword, because I think you deserve to hear it, Jeremy. Everyone who has read F. Scott Fitzgerald's original book should read Jeremy Holt's incredible retelling. Let this story do what it did for me. Transport you to a world where anything and everything is possible, and enjoy the ride. Billy fucking Porter. Oh my God. Wow. Billy Porter knows who you are. Wow. Jeremy, you're so cool.
It's surreal, to be honest. I mean, that whole week was surreal, to be honest.
I bet. Well, it's deserved. Again, Gatsby is delightful. It surprised me so much. I wasn't sure what to expect. I didn't know what it was like, LGBTQ multiracial retelling. I was like, let's find out. And it's delightful. It's more than a retelling. I'm so glad you say that in your afterword. It's a reimagination. It's a reawakening in a way of the narrative to really reflect on the 20s we're living in, as well as the roaring 20s. And that is, I don't know, when you can create, sort of put pins in two points in time and draw a string between them, I think that's really powerful stuff. And you're doing it on so many levels, not just with time, but with the different narratives, with, what you're trying to bring to it, what Fitzgerald was bringing to it, what the characters each can bring to it. And it really is, I think, just not to be missed. So I really hope that all of our listeners will pick up Gatsby. It is out now. It is gorgeous cover. Oh my gosh, I can't even get into the art because we did a little bit. So get into the art yourselves, people. It's totally worth it. It is delightful. And Jeremy, you're the best. So if folks want to learn more about you or Gatsby, where can they learn more? If you want to plug any social media or anything like that.
Sure. Very easy to follow me. It's Jeremy Holt Books, both on Twitter, Instagram, as well as my website's jeremyholtbooks.com.
And I love it when it's all the same. Well done, you. Well done, you. That's perfect. That is very easy for me. But listeners, if you didn't have a pen or pencil, or if you can't memorize that, don't worry about it. Just go ahead and click those three dots next to the title of today's episode, and you can find hyperlinks to all that good stuff. So again, Jeremy, thank you so much. Gatsby is wonderful. You're obviously wonderful. You have to come back to the pod. I'm so sorry. You're part of the group now. We'll have you back again sometime soon to talk about, all the great stuff you're working on. So thank you again so much.
Thank you.
And I wanted to say thank you so much to Sarah and Monica. You're the best. To Kate, our wonderful sound editor. You make us sound so good. And we are so grateful. We're grateful to all of our listeners, especially our patrons. Thank you so much for keeping us going strong. And I hope everybody, you take care of yourselves, because you deserve to.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.
Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @BitchesOnComics and on Instagram at @BitchesOnComics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm S.E. Fleenor. You can learn more about me at sefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at www.audreysrevenge.com or on Twitter at @AudreyRevenge.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that. As well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.